Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Be Dratty. This morning I was out at Wingfoot shooting for some U.S. Open footage and then checking out the golf course as well as some in the area. Went on a Tillinghast binge with golf architect Jaeger Kovich. We also recorded a pod, so that'll be out later, but it was a chilly morning. It was a layering morning, pure fall morning. I was wearing my Be Dratty quarter zip. It was absolutely perfect. It warmed up. I then shed it and was wearing a Be Dratty cotton shirt. So I highly recommend the quarter zip. It is a, you know, functional piece that you can wear so many different ways, whether it's to the office, on the golf course, or out and about. So check it out at bedratty.com, and look for future Wingfoot content coming up. That's actually where Billy Dratty's a member. So great spot there. I'm really excited for the next year's U.S. Open. But in this pod, Garrett Morrison and I are back. We're continuing our conversation from the last pod about our recent trip through the Carolinas. So in this podcast, we cover Roaring Gap, Aiken, which is where we had the thoroughbred. So Garrett hadn't been, and we talk about that for a little while. And then we also talk about Palmetto, which is a Alistair McKenzie design. You know, it's been worked on by Tom Doak and Gil Hance in recent years. In Aiken, it's a private club, but it also allows guest play, public play, really, the week of the Masters. Highly recommend checking it out. It's a phenomenal golf course. If you can swing the green fee, it is a great place to experience a day at. So, without further ado, here's Garrett and myself talking about our trip.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right. So after we saw Old Town Club, we had the opportunity before heading over to Atlanta and Aiken later on for the Thoroughbred, our event. We saw in the mountains of North Carolina Roaring Gap Club, which is a 1925 Donald Ross design that was restored around the same time. In fact, exactly overlapping with the restoration of Old Town Club. And the restoration chairman at Roaring Gap was, again, Dunlop White, the golf chairman at Old Town Club, who oversaw the process of restoring Old Town as well. So Roaring Gap is a really cool place. You know, it's kind of this getaway in the mountains. It's got an interesting history. It's linked with the Pinehurst Resort. And a pretty unique golf course. So what were some of your thoughts about Roaring Gap?
It's always cool to play golf literally on a mountain. I've been thinking about it a lot. It's just like a very fun golf course to play. I think you think about the place, it gets like 6,700 rounds a year, 7,000, barely anybody plays it. And you think the membership's probably shades a little bit older.
Yes.
And it's like, just like that's, it fits what it is so well, because it's not going to kill you, but it's just
right.
A fun place.
6,400 yards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you play up and you play down and around, and you play right up to the edge of the mountain, and the land is gets really, really, really good from, I would say, a whole five or six.
The one that five is the one that goes down. The par four that goes downhill.
Yeah, five, which
and then six is the volcano hole.
I'd say 5 through 12 is where is like kind of the peak. It's interesting though, the nines were flipped, and that's what I've been kind of fixated on in my head. And I tend to keep coming back to the. I wish that the nine, the routing would go back to the other way.
Interesting. Why is that?
I think it just tells a better story. I understand why they flipped it. They flipped it because the current 17th plays right out to the cliff, and then 18th is a par three that comes back to the clubhouse. And, you know, that's your kind of fairy tale ending to your day at Roaring Gap. But it dismisses the fact that the best land for golf, I think the round is more cohesive the other way, because you start in the really good land and it gives you the taste of what Roaring Gap is. 10 and 11 is a bunkerless par 5 that's just got these tremendous rolling features that kind of like they cascade in from the right and then the left, and the green sits up there. And so you kind of... You get a taste of it, and they take you away, and they bring you out, and they bring you out to that cliff, you know, and then they bring you back into the great land to finish. And I just think I've thought about this. All I've been thinking about Roaring Gap is flipping the nines back, and I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, because you know the counter argument to that would be what you mentioned earlier, that the round kind of culminates out on this cliff, that you go through the woods, and then finally in those last few holes the landscape kind of opens up, and then boom, you reach the climax right out on the very top of the mountain with that view over the valley, and then there's a long par three that takes you back to the clubhouse, and there's a certain dramatic appeal to that. But I guess what you're saying is that people may be mistaking what the actual best holes at Roaring Gap are.
Yeah.
Because 17 is not the best hole at Roaring Gap.
I would actually say 17 is the weakest hole at Roaring Gap.
You think so? Why is that?
I think it's pretty... It's just hit it here, hit it there.
Yeah. I mean, if you stay along the right side, along where the bunkers are, there's a semblance of strategy, right?
Yeah.
There that in the fairway cants a little bit to the left. When you're down at the bottom of that, it's not an easy shot. So there's a little bit of strategic unity there, but the land is pretty
flat,
basically.
And the greens vary, you know, because of so many of the greens there are dictated by the slope of the land, because you're playing on this mountain. Yeah. So like a lot of times you'll look at a hole and you're like, oh, that I'm hitting into a green that's front, back to front. And really, it's front to back because of the topography. Like, and you know, you're either playing up or down a mountain. And that is the flattest, least, you know, to me, least interesting land on the golf course.
Yeah,
and it's the green's not, you know, the green's good. It's, and this is like not an indictment. It's and you could never say that's the worst or the weak, because of the view. But like in terms of just pure golf, and it makes me think a lot about Cyprus, right? You know, where there's like layers to the routing, right? Where you see the ocean right off the first hole, right? And then they take you away from it. And that's Roaring Gap's best golf is in that section of the land that would be the start and the finish of the round. You know, and then Cyprus, you see the ocean and you come back to the ocean to finish, right? The Roaring Gap, well, the mountain is what people believe to be the ocean. Their real ocean for golf is the rolling hills that are situated on holes 5 through 12.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really well put. And I think I agree with that. That's what you really come for. That's what's exciting at Roaring Gap is the land that starts when you get to basically the top of the mountain, right? Holes one, two, three, four play uphill. And at the highest point, you see that building. And I know I should know what that building is.
It's the gray stone.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. And it's a cool building, you know? And then you get right up there basically to the lawn in front of this building. That's the fourth green. And then you walk over to the fifth tee and it's a spectacular short par four that plays downhill, dramatic contours in the fairway that dictate the strategy of the hole. The next hole after that is the Volcano par three that I think a lot of people probably like taking pictures of, that falls off really severely on the right side of the putting surface. And the seven is a par five that again goes over incredible land. These are great, great golf holes. And that basically continues until the terrain, the dramatic terrain in that section of the golf course takes you all the way through hole 12. And then there are some really cool golf holes after that too. But, you know, especially on number 11, the par five that you're describing earlier, that goes over those huge contours, is just a wonderful design.
12 is so neat too. With that,
short par four kind of goes over the shoulder of a hill, and you can see the green from some parts of the hole, and other parts of the hole you can't.
I carry around a persimmon driver, and I don't use it all the time. And about four holes into Roaring Gap, you just realize like it's a way more fun golf course to play with a persimmon driver, because that's a golf course that modern equipment has really taken a toll. But like if you put it back to the persimmon, like all of a sudden all of those features, like the 12th hole has this huge cascading ridge that runs down the right side of the fairway, and we both ended up on it. You do not want to be on it. It's a very short par four, like 350. You have a wedge in and you're just hitting from a lie that's, you know, ball way above your feet. You know it's very difficult to hit from.
And you have to cut it from there too to get anywhere near the green. Yep, your ball's way above your feet if you're a right-hander, and you've got to cut it.
Yeah, and you know, if I was playing my regular driver, I'd just hit it right over that thing. You know, I wouldn't have been even in the ballpark. But with the persimmon, I hit it right into it. I tried to hit it over and didn't get there. So it's that golf course is so fun, and it's another one where, when the ball's like alive, we played it at the end of the season and there's a lot of moisture in the air, so it was a little soft, but like when that ball's running, it's just got to be so much fun to play.
Yeah. That your ball can travel hundreds of feet even in one roll. And that's part of the adventure of the course. And yeah, if you're just hitting over those landforms, it becomes less fun. You know, since I'm a little bit shorter, the course still works for me with modern equipment, I think. But in any case, for the 11th hole, for instance, that par five, you know, the big feature of that hole is a ridge, or I guess this diagonal slope that cuts about 100 yards in front of the green, and then the land goes down into a gully and then way up to the green. And the question on that hole is, where do you want your second shot to end up? Do you want to be on top of the ridge with kind of a weird lie, but you're on the same level of the green, or do you want to go ahead and hit it past that and then have a blind shot up to the green that would be quite difficult as well? I think if you were playing modern equipment, you'd probably get your ball around the green in two shots every time. But rolling yourself back a little bit reintroduces some of the questions that the hole is supposed to ask. And it is, you know, it's a short course by modern standards. It's 6,400 yards. But man, if you're hitting the ball off the tee not much more than 200 or 225 yards, that course becomes really adventurous. And difficult because of how it just sits on this mountain and doesn't hold back in terms of taking you over the biggest landforms.
What would you say you know, what would you like to see different there?
Well, we talked about this a little bit during the round. It would be cool to see the turf in the fairways especially come to its full potential. And we saw it toward the end of the season. We saw it in October. That course closes down at the end of October, right? Basically,
I think it was the last three weeks, essentially.
Was it the last week? So even earlier. Yeah. The course is essentially shut down at this point. Its season is over. And I'm sure if we saw it earlier in the summer, we would have seen different realities in terms of the turf. But yeah, it was soggy, and the ball wasn't running like clearly it normally would. And you know, I do think that there probably could be some stuff done so that the turf is a little bit more lively through the season. Another thing that I noticed as I was playing the course is that maybe some of the mowing lines aren't quite where they could be. You know, the hole number 7 comes to mind specifically, where on the right side, there's a mowing line that kind of cuts into some area where that you might want to play with, strategically, getting your ball out there and seeing it roll. I think that's the case on a few holes.
Yeah. Some trees too.
Yeah.
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 It's,
On the front nine, or the current front nine especially, would you say?
Yeah, I'd say that. And then, you know, on the back, like, there's one between 17 and 18, the tree, there's a pine tree that, and a fairway that could be extended over on the left that would make the hole much better. But, you know, for the most part, it's really good. I don't think that course, it, for what it is, it's really good, right?
And what do you think it is? What do you think it's trying to be?
I mean, it's just like a lax place to go hang out. That's everybody that's a member there is like a second or third club, you know? And to a certain extent, like, golf is just a part of, you know, being up in the mountains, right?
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I think Donald Ross delivered exactly what the intention of that course was. It's a pleasant getaway from busier places down on flatter land. You know, it was designed as an adjunct to the Pinehurst Resort, and it sort of functions that way. It's although it's on a mountain, it's not too taxing. It's just really pleasing and a fun place to play golf. But I wouldn't call it, and I don't know if this is even a good term, I wouldn't call it a major course, right? Not in terms of major championship, but it's not a major work in Donald Ross's body of work. It's, you know, Oakland Hills and Pinehurst number 2. Those are his big, huge statements. Roaring Gap, and I made this comparison in a discussion we had afterwards, but if you're going to compare Donald Ross's courses to Bruce Springsteen albums, I don't know why you'd want to do that. It just jumped to mind, but Pinehurst number 2, and the current Donald Ross major championship courses are kind of his Born to Run or Born in the USA, those big statements, big loud, you know, albums that have a lot of instruments and spectacular songs. Roaring Gap is more like Bruce Springsteen's album Nebraska, which is acoustic, stripped down, beautiful. And, you know, it's a beautiful, lovely album that shows a different side of Springsteen, but it's not a major statement and it doesn't intend to be. I think that you could sort of see Roaring Gap the same way. It shows a different dimension of Ross's talent as an architect.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's charming, you know?
Yes.
That's the way it's a very enjoyable place to go play golf, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad we went there.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Then you got to go see Aiken. Now for a quick word from our sponsor. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Whether on the course or in the market, it helps to have a second set of eyes to keep you on your game. That's why TD Ameritrade's trade desk is here to help gut check your strategies, so you always feel confident teeing up a trade. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg to learn more about what their trade desk can do for you. Member SIPC. Now back to Aiken.
Oh, man. This was quite a trip, actually. It felt like it happened pretty quickly, but we covered a lot of ground.
I was so tired at the end of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We did quite a bit of driving. But yeah, we got over to Aiken and had our event there, played three rounds at Aiken within a day and a half. And that was a completely delightful experience. Aiken Golf Club, you've written about it on the website, but it's just a wonderful local golf course that just shows what you can do if you have an ownership that that commits themselves entirely to making the golf course as good as possible, and where they know what they're doing, you know, they just turn that golf course into a design that is better than it has any business being. So really fun to play there. It was, I think the event worked out really well. But yeah, great place. And then in the same town, you have Palmetto Golf Club on the private side, and it makes Aiken one of the best small towns for golf that I've ever seen. Maybe the best.
I actually think it is the best. I don't think there's a town, even a city, even cities that have a better private public combo. I was a little nervous before Aiken because I feel like, you know, I don't know. I had this like self-doubt creep in where I was just like maybe this golf course isn't as good as I think this golf course is. Cause like, just, I feel like not that many people had been to it, you know, like there wasn't like a, I don't know, like Tom Doak hasn't been there, you know, and there's like a little doubt that, and but then like, you know, everybody got there and played it and everybody was like blown away. It was like quite relieving, and it was like, okay, I did think like I wasn't losing my mind or something. And
no, I totally understand. I've been that way about golf courses before where nobody else is talking about them, you think it's really great, and you're like, oh, have I just gone insane?
Yeah, well, it was like the fact that all these people are going, I'm like, I hope it's not as good as I think it is, you know. Yeah. But like I was reaffirmed because, you know, the commentary afterwards. But you know, there isn't with a public golf course, like, there aren't many public golf courses that can match. Like, there are plenty of private courses that match Palmetto, but I can't think of any town that's got a public that even comes in the close, in the stratosphere of Aiken.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning how good it is. So what were you hearing from people after they played it? What were some of the comments that you heard? I'm curious.
It was just how wildly unique it is, how incredible, I mean, the greens are just incredible.
Yeah, yes. Every green's different, and there are green concepts out there, just ideas for what you could do with the total entity of the green that I just haven't seen before.
Yeah. And
I just literally haven't seen someone design a green like that before. That's what's out there at this golf course.
Well, it's because the guy had never designed a green before he designed those greens. Usually that situation doesn't work out. Like it's such a cool place. The other thing is the way it's connected to the town makes it a little bit more special too, where you can, it's a 2-minute walk from downtown Aiken, which is a nice town. It's a very nice town. You know, having been there a couple times now, like Aiken's a really nice town, and you just can walk from downtown, and then there's this golf course that's weaved in through the neighborhood. You cross roads and you go out and back, and it's just, and the best is like, it takes so little time to play the golf course. It's just not, it's like the complete opposite of every American golf course, every American public golf course in a way. Not everyone, but right. Like it's so different, wildly different.
And it's a great model of how to how to weave a golf course, as you say, into a residential community, right? Because often that doesn't work out very well. Often houses and golf courses don't go very well together. But even though the corridors out there are fairly isolated from each other, and there aren't these kind of open expanses where a bunch of golf holes are all together on the land, you're kind of going through the neighborhood out and back. In fact, the ninth hole doesn't go back to the golf to the clubhouse, right? The course wanders out and then eventually comes back, and it's through neighborhoods the whole time. But it doesn't feel like you're being encroached upon. The houses don't feel like they're on top of the course, and maybe that's just because the corridors are wide enough, and maybe it's because they're set back from the golf course well enough and concealed well enough. But the golf course is part of that residential community. And it doesn't feel like compromises the other.
I think the big difference is that the golf course was there and then the homes came.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's how it always works better.
Yeah, because you get to use the good land for golf first, and then you can fill in the residential component later.
And then like the early housing development courses were kind of the same way, like Paso Tiempo, Sedgefield was an early residential course where the golf course was selected and then the houses were built next to it. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like that, that's the appropriate way to do residential golf.
And it's not a prefabricated community, right?
Exactly.
It's an organically built community where, you know, there wasn't like a master plan or anything like that. It just grew up there. And so it feels completely natural that this golf course and this neighborhood that it's in coexist and supplement each other. It's really nice. And they have that putting course just outside the clubhouse. The clubhouse itself is cool. There's a great putting course is awesome. I mean, it's all grass putting course with a bunker in it and like cool putting holes, like well-designed putting holes. It's just so simple. It doesn't take up that much room. I was looking at this and thinking, why in the heck do we not see this other places? But you just don't. And maybe there's just the extra care that has to be put into designing and taking care of it.
But that's bullshit, but, though. The extra care that Jim McNair maintains that golf course with a crew of four guys.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
there's very little. It's very efficient.
We were planning to start the event at 8, and he's like, hey, can we push it to 8:30? I mean, it's a big task doing a shotgun at 8 here with a crew of four. I was like, oh, absolutely. You know?
That's understandable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just works in every way, from the golf course to the quote-unquote amenities around it. It's just all in its proper place and what it should be.
And then there's just some amazing holes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we can get the back-to-back short par fours on the back nine.
I think are
stunning.
The first hole's awesome.
It's a great hole. Yeah.
The third.
Yeah. Could you describe the first hole? So let's talk about that, because I still don't really know how to play it. And that's part of the magic of it.
I think I figured it out finally. I've now played the course like six times, I think. I always used to hit driver. So it's like 340 yards. And the green is up on a ridge. It's a double green, it shares the 17th green. And 18 plays back down the other way is a par three, just to give you an idea of, like, you know, length. And you've got this kind of ridge line that cuts through the center of the fairway. I mean, if you wanted to hit it onto the ridge, you have to hit it like 170 yards, 180 yards. And that leaves you like 150 yard shot to an elevated green on the first hole.
And it kicks away on all sides, right? And especially when you're looking at it, it's super intimidating because all you see is this crown, right?
It appears
to reject balls on all sides.
It's got like a big knob. McNair used a lot of like Maxwell muffins out there.
He did. Yeah, I know. Some of the greens were very Maxwell-ish.
Yeah.
I was wondering if that was just recency bias and because I had been primed to look for that stuff, but Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, is those little quirky contours in the greens that just make them so distinctive, because most people don't build with that kind of detail. They do a big tier or something large instead of just one small thing.
You know, right? I like kind of comparing them to like landmines, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like these little knobs are just so effective because they anything around them just become, you become really worried. You know, if you're putting over them, if you're trying to hit an approach shot, like you all of a sudden have to do things you don't want to do because there's a landmine right there, right? You know, and if you were like, if you knew there was a landmine in your town, like you'd have to make concessions and do things differently than the way you'd want to do them, right? It's kind of like what Mackenzie says about, like, you know, the bunker should be right where you want to hit it. Like, right where everybody wants to hit. Like, and that's the beauty of just putting a knob right in the center of a green, because that's where every good player wants to hit the ball. You know, like, none of them are really aiming at pins. Like, you kind of just like, you know, I'm going to aim over here. You know, it's like, so you got that knob in the center of the green. Sorry, got off topic there. I started thinking.
That's what happens.
And there's this
you got the knob in the center of the green, and then, in the big hollow before the green, and the green sits on the ridge.
So you kind of have to decide, like, you have to decide whether you want to play up on the ridge, and then there's, like, almost a secondary ridge before you get down to the depth of the hollow. If you hit driver, you're going to be in the depth of the hollow.
Yes.
And you're going to have, like, this weird 45-yard wedge shot, like up a hill to a green you can't see with a huge knob in it. Like, it's just
just to give an idea, that's where I was every time I played the hole.
Yeah,
every single time I was down, and every time I was like, why am I down here? Why did I play the hole this way? And I don't think I successfully executed that wedge shot once.
I just I started hitting 3-iron. And it's just, it gets me to like a spot where it's a 100-yard shot.
Do you go out right? Because out right on that hole is the 18th,
it just kicks it down.
18th hole corridor. It kicks it down a little bit because the land slopes right to low left.
You got
to
hit it right because, like, you can't hit it left. There's like out of bounds or a hazard running down the left side also. So,
Sean Martin's thicket.
Yeah, you've got like 80 yards of space to hit it into.
Yeah, so, exactly.
But it's just a cool first hole. I mean, there's so many great holes out there.
Yeah, you could go through hole by hole and talk about their unique characteristics. The bunkering out there is really cool. There's these striking contrasts. And again, maybe this is a factor of just not having been trained to do things in a conforming or common way. But the bunkering is so odd and cool, where you have these clusters of little pot bunkers, right? Of little circular bunkers contrasted with these big, wild kind of fescue. I don't know if it's actually fescue, but you know what I mean? Like long grass fringed bunkers that function as kind of waste areas. In fact, they play everything as waste areas out there. But there's these big little contrasts. And, formally shaped bunkers versus naturally or wildly shaped bunkers all over the course. And it just makes it really striking. It's just never really seen seen a course execute bunker shaping in quite that way. It was very distinctive.
You know, the other thing about it is it's golf done really well on a smaller scale. Like, the land has some good scale, like good size scale movement to it, but the features aren't huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's 5,800 yards. And I think it's like a perfect example. It's just the amount of time, it takes so little time to play. I mean, we played a six-some in the event in sub 4 hours. Six-some.
And
everybody
weren't playing, you an alternate shot 10 some later?
Yeah, alternate shot 10 some in like 3:15.
Yeah, right.
You know, and the, you know, I think some people might raise their pace of play with me, but you know, that might be one factor.
Yeah.
But
nobody wants to be the slow guy in Andy's group right at this point.
But it's just it just shows that like golf doesn't have to be massive. Like it doesn't have to be a mammoth dunes with its 90 for everybody to be able to get around and play it in a quick, timely manner. You know, it doesn't have to be 100-yard wide fairways. It's much more, and I think this is where with Tom Doak, what he's doing with the course, the third course at Sand Valley's trying to go this direction, but this is an example of it in America, right? Mm-hmm. Like it, the golf course is a par 70 just because of pure necessity of marketing. Like the reality is it's like par 67.
Yeah. Right. Cause the par fives are 450 yards.
Oh yeah.
You know, a couple of them play pretty long, but yeah, there aren't, holes that really stretch the boundaries of, on the high side of their par.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, like this is what he's, and it's a very sharp contrast from Old Town in that sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's almost by necessity that the course laterally is on a smaller scale, right? The fairways are narrower, the corridors are narrower, just because it's, you know, that's the footprint of the golf course, right? That's what they cleared out in terms of the trees, and now there are houses on the sides of a lot of the holes, and so the footprint is pretty small, and so, you know, aside from the first hole that we were describing, you know, it's funny enough, we chose the one hole with like a really ultra wide fairway. But aside from the first hole, the holes are able to do a lot of interesting things other than giving you that classic array of width-based options, right? It's not a course that really emphasizes lateral strategy that much. Instead, there's these kind of interesting diagonal lines going on. There are lots of cool things that the holes do, aside from the classic illustration of a big wide fairway that you can choose your line down.
Right? It's a lot of it's because of the topography and where you're mm-hmm. picking whether you want to be high or low. Right? Do I want to be up on top of this ridge or do I want to get it down, push it down? And there's the risk, like when you're pushing with driver is like, you know, it's not that wide. So you have to really hit a good drive, right? Like it's, you don't feel like you can just wail away at it all the time there.
Yeah. Yeah. Very few holes are a green light just to smash it.
And he does it with trees sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
Like the six hole would be a good example of that, where the green, half the green sits behind a tree. And, you know, he's, you have to play right there, you know, but there's a bunker mm-hmm. there and there's a boundary, there's a road, you know, in order to get your angle into that left pin. And there's a lot of neat stuff.
It's a golf course that people can learn from for sure, because it violates a lot of the established norms about what makes good architecture, and it just shows you the many different ways that simple ideas, manageable ideas at a public golf course can really create a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's just different than what if somebody hired, you know, outside, like nobody would be asking for that golf course right now, and everybody almost should be.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah. Every town needs one. Now, I don't know if it works necessarily in every town, but it's certainly working there. And yeah, that's the overwhelming feeling you come away with. And this is what I heard from a bunch of other people at the event, is that why aren't there more courses that do this? It seems so simple. It seems so manageable. And yet, Aiken stands as almost completely unique, at least in my experience of seeing golf courses.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
All right.
Palmetto.
So, Palmetto. Well, I'll just touch on it briefly, because you didn't play that round that morning.
I played it in the spring.
You've played it before, though. Yeah. I mean, you know, Palmetto is fantastic. What more can be said? It's also in Aiken. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Aiken Golf Club. And it's obviously a private course, but a very, very relaxed atmosphere. It's one of those places that has a local membership supplemented by a national membership. And there's a really cool, casual, golf-focused vibe at the club. You know, the head pro was incredibly friendly and talked to our group for a long time before and after the round. Just a really welcoming atmosphere, unpretentious. And then what you've got in the golf course is just one of the best sets of greens I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to describe how good those greens are, how good the surrounds are, how different they are from each other. You know, greens I find to be very hard to describe in words and very hard to photograph. You just kind of have to walk them and see them. But the best thing that can be said about those greens at Palmetto is that when there are no bunkers around them, I was going to say even when there are, but maybe even especially when there aren't any bunkers around the green, it's completely fascinating and so challenging. The contours are just really kind of expertly shaped and placed. And so it's a tremendous amount of fun to play around those greens. And each green ends up speaking to you right back to the tee, where the difficulties that you'll encounter once you get around the green will factor in when you're hitting your tee shot on additional rounds there. Every green does that. Every green is different from the last, Palmetto does not, that design does not use bunkers to create the primary interest in a hole or in a green site. It's just contour and short grass, and they're so, so cool.
Yeah, what you hit on when with the greens talking back, like if you turn around and look, it's Eric Lang did a video there with Dottie Pepper and David Normoyle.
Yeah, I saw this.
And David Normoyle is like one of the most brilliant people in golf. And it was funny because he was walking the golf course backwards. And ever since I saw him, and, you know, I had played it. And when I saw what he was doing, I thought to myself, man, I really wish I could do that, because it's such a neat golf course. And the greens are totally it. Like, I mean, I'll never forget like playing the second hole and getting to that green, and I was like, holy cow. Like, that's when I was like, my God, I am in for something today.
That's a very challenging green. Yeah. That one kicks away on all sides just about.
Yeah. And it runs away. Like, you can't even see it because it's elevated up and it runs. I think the big thing there is the atmosphere adds so much to it, because it's this very, very nice place with lots of history. And I think this might be something with just the town of Aiken, what makes it, it's such an inviting place. And, you know, you go to so many clubs and they're so the opposite way of this. And Aiken's the same way as it. And maybe that's what makes the town and why it's got the best golf of maybe any town in America, you know, in terms of public and private, is that it's just they're inviting places. Like, they're places that you want to spend time at, you know, and you're comfortable spending time at.
And the lack of pretension,
yeah,
I think, allows everybody to focus on the golf. There's not this desire at these places to show off or to, you know, present themselves as something other than a really great golf course. And so you don't see the huge clubhouse. Now, there's nothing wrong with a huge clubhouse, but that's not the choice that Palmetto Golf Club has made. You know, it's a simple, down to earth place where the focus is just entirely on great golf. The course doesn't really show off either, right? It's not hitting you over the head with its greatness. It's just got a lot of subtle features, especially in the ground contour.
I like that ground tour.
Ground tour. I know, I've coined a new term.
Yeah, you can start using that.
That's
the ground tour. Could become a buzzword.
That should be a replacement for the fried egg, actually.
Yeah.
That should be the new name of the company. Yeah. From the ground tour comes all the interest, and it's not what people notice first. It's not what shows up well in photos they're not features that scream at the top of their lungs that they're great. But once you start playing on them, once you see what the ball does on them, you can see the fun that you can have at the place. And that's Palmetto. It's just one great green after another, one great set of contours after another.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. I mean, you can definitely see, I don't know if that range was always there. I have a suspicion that it wasn't.
Maybe the holes
played
a little differently.
Yeah.
I suspect the same thing.
Yeah.
Because the 16th hole, the par three, is the only one that's, a little bit odd.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but 15, that par four is amazing.
Really cool. A bunkerless green.
Yeah.
Very short par four. Strange looking fairway from the tee that just kind of is you hit your tee shot right into the crest of this hill, and then it's a wedge into this green. And if you're too close to it, then you're trying to hit a lob wedge pitch off of short grass to you're just going to end up 40 feet past the pin if you don't get it exactly right. Great golf hole. And 17 and 18 are cool too. They're kind of wedged into this fairly small piece of land, but 18 has kind of a similar effect where it's a short par four. You have a short second shot, but there's a lot of challenge in the way that the green behaves.
You don't want to hit a driver and miss.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. There are these. What did you think of those mounds? Like those big mounds.
Around the greens?
Yeah, around so many of them.
Yeah.
It was very UK-ish.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, it was, they were, so it's one of those courses where you don't have a lot of apparent earth moving in the fairways at all. Would you say the same?
Oh, yeah.
That the fairways are super naturalistic in the way that they sit on the land. Now, I don't know what was actually moved or what wasn't, but I suspect that basically nothing was. Then around the greens, you have some pretty obviously man-made features. You have mounds around the green, but somehow or another, they never appear to be uninteresting or banal because they're not uniform. Right, it's not like there are these little dollops that sit at even spacing around the green. There are uneven shapes that look man-made, but that are really irregular and unpredictable, and create a lot of that fun that I'm talking about when you get around the greens. Because depending on where you are, you could have completely different shots. If your ball's like, you have two balls that are 6 feet away from each other, it could be a completely different shot because of the intensive micro contouring around the greens.
So Palmetto's open Augusta week to everybody.
Yeah.
It's like $400.
Mm-hmm.
Were you there? Would you pay $400 to play Palmetto?
That's a hard question to ask. I think $400 means something different to me than it means to, everybody. Would I pay $400 to play Palmetto?
Say $400, you'd pay $400 to go play Kiawah Island or Whistling Straits, mm-hmm. or,
That's what I was thinking. If I'm going to pay that much money to play Spyglass Hill, for instance. Yeah.
So this is the way
that's exactly what Spyglass Hill is.
And this is the way you have to contextualize the $400,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Compare it to other $400 courses. Does it stack up?
Absolutely. Against the courses that we just mentioned, I mean, for sure. I think it's a really wonderful golf experience. I like Spyglass Hill a lot. I lived next to Spyglass Hill for 5 years, and that's a spectacular golf course. And I think that it's maybe doesn't do everything that I want a golf course to do necessarily, but I can see why people would see it as worth it and would walk away from that golf course being really impressed. But yeah, if you're going to pay $400 to play that course, you'll get a completely different kind of experience at Palmetto, but one that I think is just as valuable and memorable. So yeah, I mean, it's hard to say what the value of a dollar is to everybody. But yeah, if they're going to open up their course and give people an opportunity to play it once and see it for that amount of money, I think it's certainly worth it.
Yeah, I agree. I that's kind of the way I've equated it, and especially with what other courses charge Augusta Week, it's like, you know, people are paying.
It's got to be a pretty decent deal.
Yeah,
compared to what some places
they're
charge.
Paying more at Sage Valley, I think, and. And okay. I think Augusta Country Club's in that $400 range, and I mean Aiken charges $100. That's the best deal by far around during Augusta Week. So
yeah, it's kind of like when there's a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, and they do this even a little bit during Pro Am Week. But Pacific Grove doubles their green fee for out of towners. Pacific Grove
advantage.
Is charging
it's running
like,
good business.
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I think it's a smart move. But yeah, Pacific Grove starts charging $120, $130 because they know that a lot of people who are coming to town have some money. They have some disposable income. They're out to spend a little bit of money and have themselves a fun vacation. And that's certainly Masters Week. When that population of people descends on Georgia and is out there to see the Masters, I think that $400 probably fits very well into plans that people have financially for that particular weekend, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree.
Yeah.
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 So
yeah, what a great trip. Yeah. That was a really, really good one.
That was a good one. It was a good one. It's in all the ones we missed still, you know, that's the trouble.
There are a ton more. North Carolina is North Carolina, South Carolina are
unbelievable golf states.
Amazing golf states. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, we talked about a lot of the classic courses. Just think of the array of modern courses that are in those states as well.
Yeah.
The different experiences that you could have, public and private.
Yeah.
It's a mecca.
Yeah. So we'll talk soon. We'll excited. You're going up to Bandon Dunes. I'm excited to hear about the sheep ranch.
Yeah. Yeah. That should be an interesting trip. I don't know what the weather is going to kind of be a crapshoot. And we'll see if the drone wants to behave. Yeah. I don't know if it's going to get there, but I'm going to see Bandon. I'm going to be there for a couple of days. Only playing a couple of rounds of golf, but definitely going to see Sheep Ranch. And a lot of the other things I'm going to be doing is just kind of walking around the resort. Because when I visited Bandon last year with my dad, we played 36 holes basically every day. And it was a really great experience, unforgettable. I'd highly recommend that everybody do it. But I found when I was playing those courses that all I really wanted to do was just go out and take a hike around them. Just go and look at them, kind of wander freely around the paths along the golf courses and just look at them. Because when you play them, it seems like it goes by so quickly. So that's a good amount of what I'm going to be doing. I'm just going to be walking around the property like I'm on a vision quest or something. So it should be pretty fun, and we'll probably get some decent photos and stories out of it. We'll see what happens.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we'll talk to you soon.